Well, since I am from this congregation, let me add my voice of welcome to all of you who are here this morning. Welcome to the Church of Christ, to those who are visiting, and a special welcome to this, our 10th annual church lectures. And greetings also to those who may be viewing this either today or in the future through the archives of the Online Academy of Biblical Studies, or through the DVDs or listening to the CDs that will be provided through Telstar. We are certainly grateful for those who take the time and the effort and provide the facilities to make a more permanent record of these presentations. The topic of this 10th annual lectures is indeed studies in Ezekiel, and this first lesson will serve as an introduction to that book. Perhaps for no other book of the Bible is the general perception of the book so disconnected from the actual things that are contained in the book. And one of the things in the book of Ezekiel that contributes to that is the complex imagery. You have a complex image and people see in it what they want to see. Some have opined that for the average reader of the Bible, the book of Ezekiel is mostly a perplexing maze of incoherent visions, a kaleidoscope of whirling wheels and dry bones that they have a great deal of difficulty understanding. Others have suggested that the implications, that the results of that complex imagery may in some cases be even worse. There are some who look to those images and believe that they see the reinstitution of the Old Testament sacrificial system. Others who are interested in science fiction, they look through the pages of Ezekiel to try to find spaceships and extraterrestrial beings. But what a misuse. What an abuse of a great work, of a great prophet of God. In reality, the book is a great record of prophecy, and it's wrapped in great literature, and indeed filled with even greater imagery. The balance of this introduction, we want to talk about the background for the book, the national, political, the spiritual background. We want to spend some time talking about Ezekiel the man, his early years, his special call, his mission, key messages he had for the people of those days, and then talk a little bit about his character. Then we want to talk about the book, the usual things about the book, the title, the authorship, the canonicity, that is, have people questioned whether or not this book should be included in the Bible. Talk about the text, the date of the book, the arrangement of the material in the book, the literary features, things that we hope will be useful to you as you study the book of Ezekiel, and as you listen to the balance of the lectures throughout this week. In the end, I'd like to preview four of the great lessons from the book of Ezekiel. Lessons for his day, lessons that are just as relevant for our day. First, the background. As we began to look at the background and the times of the writings of Ezekiel, we notice an important parallel between his writings and the other major prophets. And that is that they were God's messengers during critical times. A few years ago, in 2009 and 2010, we studied the writings of Isaiah. And we noted the writings of Isaiah centered about 721, when that northern kingdom of Israel was captured by the Assyrians. Well, Isaiah passed from the scene, and the great power of the Assyrian Empire began to fade. So here we are now, a little over a century later, and the Assyrians are fading from the scene, being replaced by the great Babylonian Empire that, in fact, would capture the southern kingdom in the days of Ezekiel. Because I wasn't sure whether or not you would have had a chance to purchase your books, I did, in fact, make a handout of one of the key figures that I have included in the introduction. If for some reason you did not get that, if you raise your hand, somebody will be glad to give you a copy of that. I thought it might be useful to look at this. And you probably need a copy in your hand. I realize that if you're in the back, the print may be small from back there. But this figure shows the key characters during the period of Ezekiel. Let me expand and look on the top row. The top row shows the leaders that built the great nation of Babylon. Nabopolassar was the one who successfully defeated the Assyrians and helped form the great Babylonian Empire. And it was his son, Nebuchadnezzar, that ultimately defeated Judah, the southern kingdom. The second row shows the kings of the southern kingdom, good King Josiah, followed by Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah. Zedekiah was the last king. He was the king when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah and destroyed Jerusalem. Now, In the bottom part of the graph, it shows the prophets of the era. There was Jeremiah. Jeremiah was the one who stayed behind in Jerusalem and ministered to the people of God who were there. You may recall the books of Jeremiah and Lamentations were the subject of this series of lectures in 2007, 2008. Then you see Daniel. Daniel was one among the brightest and the best of Judah. So he was one of those who were carried away in the first groups in 606 BC, carried away to Babylon. His work there was among the ruling class in the capital city of Babylon. Now, the current plan is to study Daniel next year. Then we come to Ezekiel. Ezekiel was carried away in the second group of captives in 597. And of course, Ezekiel the man, his message, his book, that's what we're planning to study this week. His work, unlike Daniel, who was among the ruling class, the work of Ezekiel was among the common people in the area of Babylon, probably in the suburbs. And it was there that he resided before and during and after the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, what was the spiritual condition of the people at this particular time? Those to whom Ezekiel was to prophesy, those with whom Ezekiel was to work. Well, actually, we have a very unflattering description of the spiritual condition of the people in God's own words, in the words of the warning that God gave to Ezekiel. He said, "But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee," speaking of Ezekiel, "because they will not hearken unto me," God says. "For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted." Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 7. This was the background, the military background, the political background, the spiritual background, when the book of Ezekiel opens with these words. "Now it came to pass in the 30th year, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel the prophet, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar. And the hand of the Lord was there upon him." And really, much of what we know of the early years of Ezekiel is contained in these few verses. It is indeed significant that he identifies himself as a priest. Ezekiel, being a prophet and holding the additional office of a priest, really made him one of the select few who held those two offices. And in fact, among those who were both a prophet and a priest and wrote a book, the other two are Jeremiah and Zechariah. And knowing of this priestly connection maybe helps us understand what would otherwise perhaps be a vague reference in the beginning of the book to the 30th year. Knowing of his priestly connection may indeed indicate that that was his age at the time that he began to write this book, since 30 years of age was the age at which those who were eligible officially entered the priesthood, Numbers chapter 4, verse 3. If that's true, then Ezekiel was born about 623 B.C. That means that in his earliest years, he would have witnessed the reforms under Josiah. Josiah, King Josiah, had diligently sought to reform the people in terms of their idolatry. And he was successful in removing some of the outward signs, places where they worshipped. But as time went on, what we found was that he had not really managed to remove idolatry from the hearts of the people. Ezekiel would have been about 14 years old at the time of Josiah the good king's untimely death in 609 B.C. And the kings who followed good king Josiah were not good kings. They brought instability to Judah, which steadily fell under the control of the expanding Babylonian empire. In 606, when Jehoiakim rebelled against Babylon overlords, Nebuchadnezzar came against him and captured Jerusalem. Later, Jehoiakim very audaciously declared independence from Babylon. And as a punishment for that disloyalty, Nebuchadnezzar removed from Jerusalem to Babylon about 10,000 of the residents. And he took some of the best. He took some of the ruling class, some of the craftsmen, some of the best soldiers. Among those who went away in this group of 10,000 was indeed Ezekiel. But it was about five years after he was relocated to the area of Babylon that he began his very special mission to the house of Israel. Ezekiel was married, had a house of his own, and as was the case with many of the other exiles, lived a relatively free existence. His wife, however, was taken away from him very suddenly and taken away from him purposefully by God. In chapter 24, verse 16, we find that Ezekiel's wife was the eye of thine eyes. Well, the temple was the eye of the people, the desire of their eyes, chapter 25, verse 25. So it may very well have been that the taking away of Ezekiel's wife was indeed a parallel to the people losing their precious temple. And of course, her death in many ways would also portend many, many deaths to come. As indicated earlier, Ezekiel was probably about 30 years old when he began his very special prophetic mission. The language used in the call of Ezekiel is what involves that startling imagery of the whirlwinds and the wheels and the winged creatures that was to become the hallmark of his writings. Ezekiel's mission, his mission as is the mission of all of God's messengers, comes directly from the purposes of God. With respect to man, the purpose of God is to lead man into a right relationship with God. To accomplish this great purpose, God has an amazing array of events, especially in the miraculous times. God has at his disposal an amazing array of events that he can use to influence mankind. But for these events to have their intended effect, man must understand those events in light of the needed change in their behavior. It is the role of the prophet to help the people understand the lessons from God and to encourage the proper response by the people. Key messages that he had for his people, for the people to whom he worked. Let me suggest four key messages. One of his missions was to provide instructions about the expectations of God. God is a holy God. God is a loving God. Sin is both offensive to his holiness, and sin is an ungrateful response to the loving grace that he has manifested toward his people. Rebellion in any form, but perhaps especially that of idolatry, was going to bring consequences appropriate to the sin. A second key mission or theme or message was indeed to provide some insights about the actions of God. Ezekiel's task was to help the people understand that the actions of the nations around them was indeed the hand of God working out his will. They needed to learn to see their captivity as a necessary act of God, as a necessary act of a God whose justice demanded the punishment for the rebellion, but a God whose wisdom knew that their captivity was necessary to break their deep and their chronic apostasy. Especially in the days of Ezekiel, it was important for this prophet to remove the false expectations that the people had. Feeding the resistance of the people to the divine instructions was their trust in false messages, their trust in false messengers. False messages accepted by the people were major stumbling blocks in their return path to God. Because of the messages, the false messengers, they failed to realize the true character of God. And failing to realize his true character, they were all too willing to accept and believe the light sentence, the only minor inconvenience that was promised by those false messengers. Another false concept that the people had was that Jerusalem and the temple were just so special to God that they could never see calamity. And this helped really build their presumptuousness. They had a presumptuous confidence that the blessings that they had experienced from God would continue on and on. The people needed to understand. They had failed to understand, or they had chosen to ignore the fact that God had placed conditions on the continuation of those blessings. An important work, as you'll see throughout the next few days of the work of Ezekiel, was to remove those false expectations that the people had. The fourth message or the fourth mission was to give hope to the people, to give hope to the people by showing them, by helping build their confidence that God is ultimately going to to bring about his purpose. Not their rebellion, not the surrounding nations, was going to keep God from eventually working out his will with those people. So typical of those many prophets who prophesied during traumatic times, Ezekiel's message of warning was followed by a message of hope. There would, for example, be that encouraging vision of the valley of dry bones, where by God's grace, his people would be restored to a full and healthy nation, and they would be restored to their right relationship with God. And about the hope, there are those hints in the book of Ezekiel of a coming Messiah and all that he would represent. In the book, in his actions, we learn a lot about the character of Ezekiel. Let me just suggest to you briefly that we get some insights about his character from his name. The name Ezekiel can either mean God hardens or God strengthens. And both were very apt descriptions of the character and the things that Ezekiel did. To deliver a message of exhortation to a hard-hearted and hard-headed people, Ezekiel was going to need to be hard. God was going to harden him for that important mission. He also, though, was to be more than a hardener. God is more than a hardener. God is a strengthener. And through Ezekiel, God would indeed provide strength to the people. Ezekiel was a man who was endowed with a rare combination of passion that God's will should be done, and yet having compassion on the people who were suffering the consequences for their sin. He had the courage to articulate the verbal messages that were to be delivered through him, but he had the self-control, he had the humility to play some very strenuous roles in the dramas that he was to act out as a part of his message. This is something about the character of the man Ezekiel. Let's turn our attention now to the book. We want to talk about the usual things, the title, the authorship, the text. The title of Ezekiel is not complex. As with the book of Isaiah and the book of Jeremiah, the book is named for the man who wrote it. The authorship, in the book of Ezekiel, 46 times in 46 verses, we find the words that the word of the Lord came to me, or the word of the Lord came unto me. Well, who was the person to whom the word of the Lord came? The answer is in verse 2. The word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel. About the author, you know, many times the critics will try to suggest a number of different authors for a book. Well, this book has a uniformity of language, a uniformity of themes, and it has that autobiographical style that suggested it was indeed written by one author. Of course, through the years, as it is with all books of the Bible, there are those who have tried to question things about the Bible, question things about the book. For those who have tried to question the authorship of Ezekiel to this book are usually people who want to deny the supernatural. They do not want to accept predictive elements. They do not want to accept the prophetic elements contained in Ezekiel. Therefore, they suggest that the book must have been written at a later time by a different person. They try to turn God's great prophecy into a history book written reflectively at a later time. And really, it's in a similar denials of prophecy that have brought about at least some resistance to accepting Ezekiel as a part of the canon, as one of the books of the Bible. It's interesting to me, in particular in the case of Ezekiel, the critics seem to be so desperate to be critical that in a lot of the cases, their criticisms cancel each other out. What we find is that the critics wind up making statements that, in fact, are critical of other people's criticism. So, despite a few minor objections along the way, the canonicity, that is, the fact that Ezekiel does indeed belong in the Bible, has never really seriously been challenged. Now, the text, the actual words that occur in the book, it has presented some interesting challenges to the scholars and the translators. For many ancient books that have come through to modern times, the confusion has been about the accuracy or the inaccuracy with which the words have been transmitted. In the case of Ezekiel, it's not so much the accuracy of the transmission of the text, But the uncertainties have been, what do those words mean? Ezekiel uses a number of words that he is one of the few people to use the words. They are rarely used in that time period. So getting enough insight to understand exactly what the word means sometimes has been challenging. But through the years, the scholars have worked out most of the differences. The remaining differences perhaps you see reflected in the marginal notes of the translators. But by today, understanding the great symbolism in the book is a much greater challenge than any of the remaining issues that have to do with the text. The date and arrangement, as indicated earlier, Ezekiel began his prophetic ministry about 593. He prophesied through the times of the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and on until about 571. And it was probably roughly over the next 9 years, between 571 and 562, that his messages were recorded. There are a lot of dates in the book of Ezekiel. James Smith says that Ezekiel displays a chronological character unparalleled in any prophetic book except perhaps that of Haggai. 13 dates are explicitly given. 12 of those are the dates of a particular message came to Ezekiel. The other date is the date of the arrival in the area of Babylon of the messenger who brought the story of the destruction of Jerusalem. One interesting thing about the dates that are given there, they're given based on the years of the deportation of King Jehoiachin. Although he had been replaced with Zedekiah was kind of perceived as just a puppet ruler of the Babylonian Empire. And the dates are given with respect to Jehoiakim, the last legitimate king. Another thing interesting about the dates is that for these particular dates, scholars, using a combination of astrology and archaeology, have been able to convert those dates fairly accurately into our modern calendar. If you look at figure 3 in the book, you will see that I have given a couple of interpretations of those dates. It's kind of interesting to be able to see month, day, and year in our calendar exactly when those events occurred. Despite the sections that are kind of chronologically grouped, there is indeed an overarching theme and arrangement to the book. Judah's fall is somewhat characteristic. The events before the siege are chapters 1 through 24. Judah's foes, prophecies during the siege, chapter 25 through 32. And then about Judah's future after the siege, chapter 33 through 48. A lot of the interest in the book of Ezekiel has to do with the literature that's there, the literary features. You know, for most pieces of literature, if you assess the literary style, the writing style of the author, that would suffice. But in the case of this book, that does not begin to address the richness of the ways that he communicated. If you want to talk about his writing style per se, one of the things that strikes us about it is the great variety of speech types that he employed. Prose, poetry, diatribes, mock laments, songs, various types of message oracles. But the writing is rich. With these different features, the writing is rich, but the nonverbal communications are even richer. More perhaps than any other prophet, Ezekiel used symbolic physical actions to convey his messages. And maybe we can appreciate that. This kind of multimedia message, the actions of the prophet, the things that were occurred in addition to his words, maybe that was very appropriate to his circumstances. He was an unwanted messenger that was delivering an unwanted message to reluctant listeners. Many of his messages were mimed or they were acted out. I have a longer list in the book, but just as a bit of a preview, you'll notice the time that he lies on his left side and then right side to indicate the number of years of the apostasy of Israel and Judah. There's the image of him putting luggage through the hole in the wall to symbolize the coming exile. There is the image of him trembling while he is eating to show the impending judgment. In fact, even his ability for verbal communication was turned off and on as a part of the message. There were times that God made his tongue cling to the roof of his mouth. And then there were the visions. Now, the vision itself would have been a very individual and personal experience as he received the vision. But the telling of the vision to the people was a profound prophetic message. A part of the literary feature is this apocalyptic language. Apocalyptic language is one of the distinctive characteristics of the book of Ezekiel. The term apocalyptic is from a Greek word that means to uncover, hence to disclose or reveal. Now, Ezekiel is one of three books in the Bible that is especially noted for the use of this apocalyptic language. The other two are the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation. And it is likely not a coincidence that in the case of these three books, they were written by an occasion when their authors were out of their homeland. Those who were not within the security of their homeland, they had vital information that needed to be delivered to their intended audience, but information that could be harmful if it was understood by the nations that were controlling them. Thus, perhaps we can see the importance of recording information in the code, if you will, of apocalyptic symbols. Apocalyptic books, like the book of Ezekiel, are noted for their highly elaborate, often outlandish figures and symbols and imagery. And specifically, the scope of apocalyptic language is far greater than that of typical prophecy. Apocalyptic writer often combines the present and the past and the future all in one unit, all in one scene. And that apocalyptic language is indeed one of the distinguishing features of the book of Ezekiel. A preview of four great lessons from the book of Ezekiel. There are many lessons that are there. I have chosen four that seem to me especially illustrated by the book of Ezekiel, and four that are indeed relevant to us today. Lesson number one, God greatly desires man to be in a right relationship with him. There can be no doubt that God greatly desires the relationship with his creation, but that relationship with God has got to be on his terms. When man does not meet those standards, God, because of his love and because of his mercy, yearns for man to return to that right relationship. We have an example of that pleading message from God through Ezekiel in chapter 33, verse 11. God says to Ezekiel, "Say unto them, as I live, saith the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn ye, God pleads, from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel?" Well, that same God, still loving, still willing to forgive, makes the same plea to the people today. John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Lesson number two, ultimately, the changing of man's heart is a work of God. The changing of man's heart is a work of God. In his desire for a relationship with man, God has reached out to man in wonderful and unmistakable ways. It is God's desire, it is God's goal to change man's heart. But this change is not brought about by directly controlling man's heart or directly controlling man's will. God brings about this change by the external influences that he brings into the life of people. In the days of Ezekiel, it was God that brought about the circumstances around the nation that motivated the change in their heart. Through Ezekiel, God said, "A new heart also I will give you, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you an heart of flesh." Chapter 36, verse 26. Today, what a rich history we look back upon is when we see the things that God has done for us, his creation. From the creation itself, to God's faithful fatherhood of the nation of Israel, to the giving of his only begotten Son, we have powerful information. We have powerful events that should influence us to incline our hearts to God. In the end, changing of man's heart is indeed the work of God. The Apostle Paul just simply tells us, Romans 2:4, that it is the goodness of God that leads us to repentance. Lesson number 3, God holds each of us individually accountable. Now, there were undeniably times that the sins of the few brought consequences on the many. In Ezekiel's day, the whole nation was suffering because of the sins of a few, perhaps especially their national religious leaders. The message of God's Old Testament prophets in particular often has a national tone, but that was not always the case. Ezekiel, perhaps more so than any other Old Testament prophets, sets forth the personal responsibility of each person for his guilt. Could he have possibly been clearer than he was in that classic passage in chapter 18, verse 20? The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. And it is with equal clarity to that of Ezekiel that the Apostle Paul talks about our individual accountability for what we do while we're here on this earth in this body. 2 Corinthians 5:10, Paul writes, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad." Lesson number 4. False messengers can cost us our souls. Where in the scriptures do we find more tangible examples than in Ezekiel of how the work of false teachers stands between man and his right response to God? In those days, the messages of the false teachers distorted the character of God. They distorted the promises of God. By distorting the character of God and the promises of God, they worked together to provide the people a more palatable alternative than responding to God with the righteousness that he demanded. You know, the greatest enemy of what's right is what's easier. And it's not different today. False messages work in essentially the same way today. They distort the character of God. They distort the promises of God. They say, in distorting the character of God, they essentially define whole new gods. They say, my God would never send anyone to an eternal hell. My God just wants me to be happy in whatever I do. My God wants me to do things as worship that make me feel good on the inside. And when they identify those characteristics as characteristics of their God, they are being exactly accurate. Because that is their God. They've made him up. They've made up their own gods according to the way they want him to be. False messengers today, as those of Ezekiel's day, they distort the promises of God. And they do so much in the same way as the messengers in the days of Ezekiel. Note the similarities as we look through the book. By leaving out the details of the conditions that have been attached to God's promises. The danger of false teachings, irrelevant, a vital message today that is dramatically illustrated in the book of Ezekiel. In summary, Ezekiel's prophetic work spanned a total of 22 years. His ministry preceded the 586 destruction of Jerusalem by 7 years, and it continued 15 years after it. Ezekiel was God's messenger to God's captive people during one of their darkest hours. The people of Ezekiel's day were focused on their promised land. Once they were removed from that promised land, they wanted to return to that promised land. Ezekiel taught Israel that before they could return to their promised land, they had to turn their hearts again back to God. To reach our promised land of heaven, we too must have our hearts turned in the right direction. Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, the Apostle Paul says, set your affections, sometimes we would call that the heart, set your affections on things above not on things on this earth. In our quest for our promised land of heaven, we have a lot to learn from these prophets of old. These prophets of old help lay the foundation for our journey by the principles that they taught, by the character that they displayed. If we will let them, if we will study them so that we can let them teach us, they will teach us much about God and the relationship that He so badly wants to have with each one of us. So please join us this day and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday as we look at Ezekiel, one of those olden prophets, at the man, at his message, at his book. Join us as we look through the eyes, as we look through the eyes and the heart of the prophet Ezekiel, at how a holy God works with loving discipline to recover and restore a wayward people. Thank you all very much.